This is URN.
The Culture Show Breakdown.
Next winter, London might get a tropical paradise festival, complete with a waterfall, rainforest and swim-up bars. The festival will be called Summerland, and the mind behind it is a woman that is also organised and also involved in Glastonbury. It will include a real rainforest, beach and a DJ booth on top of the waterfall, complete with Caribbean huts and crystal caves. There will even be an Indiana Jones maze. And the room and waterfall will all be heated to create the illusion of summer weather. So it's basically one room. I think it's got capacity for 3,000 people. And you buy a ticket and then you get to imagine you're in a tropical island, even though you're in the middle of freezing cold, dreary London.
So it's like Splashland. I'm sort of generalising here. Sort of like the water parks you can get.
Yeah,
they're indoors.
It's a little like that, but like, it's kind of almost like a summer festival. I think that's what they're trying to.
But there's no. Is there any live music?
There's DJs and there'll be live acts and headliners, but that's yet to be released. It's all very hush hush at the moment.
Mm.
And tickets will be priced between £18 and £60, depending on the time slot and the acts playing, which I think is actually. Considering, like,
that's quite reasonable.
And the whole thought process behind it was that what do we all want to do in December and January? We want to have a sun and tropical holiday. Although I actually really love the winter, and I think this is an awful idea.
I like the winter, and I do. But
Christmas.
In London, you've got to think. In London, they don't get the snow that we get up here, and you certainly get up in.
I'm down south.
You're down south. I was going to say, well, snow where I get quite a bit of snow.
Oh, yeah, the downs, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful snowy weather.
I do like the snow, but I can understand why, sort of, if you don't have the money to sort of go abroad and end up on a Caribbean island, which a lot of people don't.
Go spend a sweaty box in the middle of London.
No, it won't be sweaty because there's...
It will be sweaty because there's
water there, so, like...
Yeah,
it's
condensation.
It's basically going to be a glorified swimming pool, really.
Yeah, I think...
I wonder if they have one of those wave machines.
That would be fun. I just think it's winter. I actually love the winter. I look forward to it even during summer. And I think embrace it. We already have the Winter Wonderland at Hyde Park, which is really lovely. It's getting a bit tacky. But
yeah, although there's the fact that it's suddenly, over the last couple of days, got exceedingly cold.
It has. It was -2 last night.
I certainly felt like it was -2. I had my electric blanket on.
I've started wearing a woolly hat, even though hats do not suit me at all.
Mm.
And, like, massive gloves.
Beanie hats don't suit me.
No, I've got a really round head, so it just accentuates the roundness.
So anyway, if any of the listeners are thinking of going to, thought about going abroad, but now think they'd much rather go to this London tropical paradise for half the price, and you don't have to get one bag through customs, do send us a message in. You can send us a free web text at urn1350.net. And on the topic of, we're going to stay around the topic of tropical islands. You say that you wouldn't go to an event such as this. What if the acts were really good musically?
Well, considering it's so reasonably priced, maybe, but no, it's not for me, the whole summer tropical. I think what they're trying to do is create kind of an illusion of summer, but I think it's winter, should embrace it. However, it does sound like it's going to be, like, really visually stunning. They're going to have, like, crystal caves underneath the bars and a real waterfall. So I think it'll be an interesting spectacle, and it depends what the acts are, maybe. Maybe I'd be tempted.
Now, I recently went to a sculpture viewing of Dame Elizabeth Frink, who, for those of you who don't know, was a very, very renowned scholar who unfortunately is no longer with us in the 20th and 21st century. And she, all her sort of commissions, she did a lot of commissions for around London. So there are a fair few around London. There are a few in Manchester. There's one in the airport in Dublin. And that they're all tiny. They can be small sculptures, no bigger than 30 centimeter ruler, to huge life size bronze sculpture of horses and sort of animals. There are three themes through her work, but they're not. I won't be able to explain them as well as the. Head curator of the Dame Elizabeth Frink estate. So that is who you will hear now, discussing a bit about the history and discussing how I got on and how I interpreted the sculpture. Because sculpture is all about how you interpret it yourself, because every piece is completely different. So here is Anita, Annette, head of the estate.
Annette, can you tell us a bit about Dame Frank's life? More importantly, the story behind the commission that's been put on.
I'll tell you the story behind the exhibition. So Elizabeth Frink was born just before the Second World War, and then during the Second World War, she was quite a young child, but she was about 11 when it started. And it had its own impact on her and her experience, because she grew up amongst the sort of aerodromes of the Bomber Command in East Anglia. Was sent away for safety, but still got caught up in various things, her and her brother. And then by the end of the war, despite her family history, which had no artistic background, she decided she wanted to study art, and sculpture was the thing that she wanted to study. So she went to Guildford and Chelsea. And while she was at Chelsea, she really focused in on sculpture and started to develop her own sort of sculptural language, very influenced by things that were going on in Europe that she may have seen from Rodin, Giacometti. This sort of expressionist sculpture, rather than the sort of pre-war English sort of direct carving of Moore and Hepworth. So she was more interested in the expressionist sculpture. And her tutor, Vernon Meadows, was also interested in that. And a little group of male sculptors older than her, that was the sort of direction they were sort of exploring. So she became known for that and recognised incredibly early through exhibitions. There were exhibitions going on as well in London, because at the end of the Second World War, there was this real need to rebuild Britain from the bombed cities. And also there was the sort of earlier throw over from the 20s and 30s, where people were thinking, we really need to change the living conditions of the people of Britain, and we're going to look at models that come from Europe, but also come from the Garden City. So there's this sort of fusion. So when Liz emerged as an artist, that's the world she came into, and her work was taken, embraced by some of these commissioners who were trying to rebuild the sort of cityscapes of inner London and other cities and create these new towns. At the same time, to accompany that, there was a whole new raft of modernist churches being built, where worship was more communal, rather than going back to the earliest times of the sort of Christian faith. So she was attracting commissioners to look at her work and gaining some very significant commissions. And although the commissioners were very specific in terms of the environments in which they were going to go into, so these new environments, she was actually able to continue with the themes and interests that she had already developed in terms of her own artistic interest and focus. So she was very influenced by expressionism, a sort of modern take on expressionism, and she was very concerned with, if you like, humanist ideals and what it means to be human.
Having studied the Greek sculptures and the Roman sculptures, they look for the perfections of man. Mm. It's completely smoothed down. Actually, staring at that one there, she is trying to show the flaws of human nature.
Yeah. The fact that we can, it's a constant theme throughout her work, throughout her life, what man is capable of doing to man, what humans are capable of doing to one another, what brings out this sense that violence and atrocity and aggression, but at the same time that within that there is a sense of vulnerability, not only with the victim, but a sort of inherent vulnerability within the aggressor, in the fact that they are flawed, that they have this deep sort of inner lack of grounding. So she's looking at that, and those are the pieces that she puts out. One of the first major commissions is Blind Beggar and Dog. So she has this medieval sort of hero who, for Bethnal Green, and he is the blind beggar, and he is guided by his dog, and he is blind because he's been involved in the Crusades, and he's come back from the Crusades very sort of damaged. And then you have something like Birdman. Birdman's very interesting because she often looked at photojournalism sometimes for some of her inspiration, and she loved the journals such as Life magazine and some of those others, and the photojournalism's going. And Birdman comes from a particular story. She always says she sort of reinvented myths. And the other thing that becomes very apparent in her work as she moves on is that she finds her new heroes, and her heroes are ordinary people. People, as in sort of next door, like with Tribute Head, people who have perhaps been tortured, who have been prisoners of conscience. So Tribute Head is used as a sort of tribute, also later on not commissioned for it, but used by the government of Southern Ireland to sort of honour Nelson Mandela. You've got the walking Madonna, the sort of female who's sort of going out into the world, you know, sort of facing the world after an atrocity. And then into that, this sort of sense of dignity and heroism that's invested in ordinary people, she brings animals. Because she starts to compare, she starts to think about, once she goes to France and then moves back to Dorset, how animals react to one another, how they deal with situations. And so she sets those up. We have this wonderful drawing next door where you've got the human being sort of holding up his hands to the baboon, almost sort of seeking answers to this sort of unknown sense of what goes on inside the sort of human sort of species. Because this exhibition is a very personal exhibition, it's not a review of her work or retrospective, it's telling this story.
So it's a biography, you could say?
It has sort of biographical sense, where we create, well, we're evoking one of her last studio, so people can, we're showing film, we're getting people to get up quite close to Liz and sort of get a sense of her as a person.
Are you going to give a sort of guided tour to
There'll be many guided tours.
Or can people just wander around by themselves?
They can do both, but there will be there'll be weekly guided tours. There's also a series of lectures as well. Annette will be coming back in the new year to talk about all the stories. There's a catalogue. We've got specialists on post-war architecture who are going to give the context for the sort of urban development schemes that Frink was providing sculpture for. And then we also have somebody who's going to be talking about specifically about the sacred commissions as well.
And there are lots of educational activities for younger people and for older people, like someone who's interested in bronze casting.
If you want to have a go at creating plasters in exactly the way that she did, using scrim and same way that you would, you know, mend a broken leg sort of thing. But it's great fun, building armatures, putting on this plaster, using bits of wood and debris to build it up, as you can see, you know, in this piece that's in front of us.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of different activities, some of them participatory and some of them to sort of...
And also we welcome everybody, families, children.
Yeah.
In fact, there will be something that...
We'll suit
parents who are coming round with little ones don't have to think,
You can sort of leave them there with the father, and the mother can go, I'll see you in 40 minutes, and just walk around.
Yes, they can come in there. There's a wonderful dog in the studio called Gosh Dog. Liz did lots of charity work, and one of the last things she did was to make this little dog for Great Ormond Street Hospital. And we're going to build up a few things for children. So we've created a little viewing theatre sort of place, so that children can sit down and get up close to some of these little plasters and things.
And we should, of course, say students. I'm very much welcome students to come in, either, on your own to look around. If there are any student groups who would like us to organise a special guided tour for them in times to suit, then we can do that too.
So I'm very grateful to be allowed to go round, as you could probably hear from the audio there. They were still setting up, so there was...
I could hear the chainsaw.
Wasn't a chainsaw. I think it was a stone cutter or some kind of cutter. It might have just been an ordinary wood saw. I'm very grateful to both Annette and Neil Walker for allowing me the chance to go around.
This is URN.
The Culture Show Breakdown.